Chapter 20, It's Greek to Me by Willie Snow Etheridge. 20, A Salonika Weekend. One sad Saturday afternoon in late March, I left Athens for Salonika. The roommate had sent me word that the commission was leaving Greece shortly, and if I wanted to travel with him through Bulgaria and Yugoslavia, I'd better come fast. Naturally, I came fast. In fact, I flew to him with Mr. R.T. Wendell, the British delegate, in a cub-sized plane assigned to him by His Majesty's government. Fortunately for me, he had come to Athens to confer with Sir Clifford Norton. Mr. Wendell is a short, stocky Englishman with thin, silky white hair, bright blue eyes, and fat pink cheeks. He has been exceedingly active for a great many years in Britain's Labour Party. The roommate refers to him frequently as the Jim Farley of the Labour Party. The trip to Salonika was beautiful. We kept over the sea most of the way, and it was inhabited with innumerable moss-green-shaped islands, shaped like alligators and turtles and many clawed crabs. But as we neared Salonika, we saw on our right and our left towers of mountains camouflaged with haphazard streaks of snow. "My word, there's Mount Olympus," Mr. Wendell cried in his clipped British tongue, pointing to the highest cone on our left. "A beauty she is, too, a rare beauty." His eyes danced, and his cheeks seemed to me to grow pinker and fuller. Somewhere on the right, in a rocky range, were the famous monasteries of Mount Athos, where no females were allowed to set foot. The pilot tried to show them to me, but I never could quite make them out. Later, I was sorry I had not strained my eyes harder, for Harry Howard of the United States delegation, whom I met when I first reached Athens, spent what was left of the afternoon after I reached Salonika telling me of a visit he had made there. He and I were sitting in the narrow whitewashed room which he, previous to my arrival, had shared with a roommate in the Ritz Hotel. Now, the Ritz is nothing like its name. It is a small, narrow, crowded building of four or five stories on a dirt square where neither grass nor flowers grow. But beyond the square stretches the blue bay of Salonika, an arm of the Aegean, and across the bay rises a roller coaster of mountains, ascending and descending to the sky, touching breathtaking Mount Olympus. As soon as I unpack, I settle in the window to soak in this scene, and Harry, the only member of the United States delegation not in a committee meeting, tilts his chair back against the wall and talks. Distracted by the new and exciting view, I listen with only one ear. Governor General Rhodopoulos was going to Mount Athos on a recent trip, Henry began, and he asked if any of the delegates on the commission would like to go. We left Salonika about 7 o'clock in the morning on a Greek destroyer. Had a beautiful day, 6.5 hours. There were 20 monasteries. Priests in wonderful vestments blessed us all. That's the reason I'm spoken of now as Holy Harry, and Dr. C of the Chinese delegation is the Holy C. My favorite hymn used to be, "Here I raise my Ebenezer," but now it's "Holy, holy, holy." I turn from the window and look at Harry. His face is long and serious, his gray eyes behind their glasses steady and sober. I turn back to the window and Harry goes on talking. They chanted the whole thing, Byzantine chant. I thought the monk next to me was yelling, "Last and last and last and last." Went to their library, richly illuminated manuscripts, splinter of the true cross. The chariot of the sun plunges behind a soaring curve of the roller coaster, and the sky is orange-red with the flames that consume it. In the foreground, the mountains, by comparison, look a cool, faded lavender. They had 7 kinds of fish that night. It was Lent, and by God, I don't like fish. Harry's voice goes on. I ate bread and drank Turkish coffee. The water in the bay is gold from the reflection of the sky. 2 slim Greek destroyers stand at the wharf side by side. A radio on one is playing, "Saturday night is the loneliest night in the week." It sounds queer here on the far shores of the Aegean. Now, the reason for the visit of Governor General Rhodopoulos, Harry is recounting, was to investigate the rumor that there was a cow on Mount Athos. Now, you know, no female animal has been allowed on Mount Athos in centuries, not even an unshaven boy. The radio on the destroyer is now playing something from Oklahoma. I cock my ears more keenly in that direction. Ducks and geese and chicks better scurry. Thanks to bandit activity, Harry's voice rises above the Surrey with the French on top. Peasants have driven their flocks down that way, and there seems to have been a cow on Mount Athos. She was utterly frivolous, gave birth to a calf, and the monks have been raising hell about it. I turn again and peer through the dusk at Harry. He still looks solemn as a statue. Maybe if I turn on the light, but then the sunset will not seem so bright. Now, says Harry, I did not see this cow myself, but Francisco Urrutia, the Colombian representative, saw her and took a picture of her. But I did see a flock of sheep with some little lambs. The sky pales to a yellow pink, and the mountains grow purple. Night is right upon us. Once Lord Curzon was reading dispatches from Salonika. Night or no night, it is all the same to Harry. And he came across, but what Lord Curzon came across has to be saved for another day, for at that moment the roommate and the other members of the United States delegation arrive. Besides the roommate and Harry and Ace Miller, who is away at the moment in Washington with Ambassador McVeigh, there are three regular members of the United States group. One is Cy Black, a tall, gangly, broad-shouldered individual who carries himself with an air of timidity and uncertainty, but he must know where he is going, for he is a professor of history at Princeton and the author of several erudite books. When the roommate went to Bulgaria and Romania in the fall of 1945 for the State Department, I went with him, and they have been close friends ever since. The other two members are Harding Bancroft, a 6 foot and more blonde, and Norbert Anschutz, a 6 foot and more brunette. They are both graduates of Harvard, both have jobs with the State Department, and both are in their 30s. Harding further in than Norbert. There are also two young male secretaries, Don Bell and John Erminger. Immediately, we must celebrate a new addition to Norbert's family. He has just received a cable that his wife in Washington has given birth to a girl. The baby is already 10 days old, but Norbert has been with one of the commission's 7 teams of investigation into the mountains of Albania, where no message could reach him. After drinking the baby's health, the roommate announces he is glad to see me. I'm amazed and touched. Yes, he says, he considers me a more satisfactory roommate than Harry. Harry is terrible, he says, simply terrible. He doesn't know how he has shared a room with him all these weeks. Harry, it seems, wakes up every morning at 6:50, flops over in his bed, which is a frail, squeaky thing, and staring straight at his watch says, I wonder what time it is. To which the roommate, who until that moment has been sound asleep, says nothing. Then, having decided it is 6:50, Harry says, Say, Mark, do you think I ought to get up, or do you think it is too early? Still getting no answer from Mark, he gets up, fools around with his razor for a little while, and says, Say, Mark, do you think I ought to sharpen this razor this morning? It's pretty dull. Do you think a little sharpening would help it? Still receiving no response from the roommate, Harry gets out something resembling an old-fashioned coffee grinder and works away at his razor, raising the goose flesh on the roommate's back. This done, he proceeds to problems of the bath. I think I'll take my bath now, he announces. I wonder if there's any hot water this morning. Yesterday morning, the water was cold as ice. Bathed, he says, I think I'll get dressed now. Dressed, he says, I think I'll go have breakfast. Out he goes, but before the roommate has got to sleep again, he's back. He takes off his coat, pushes a chair away from the wall, hangs his coat upon it, puts his hands together, and says, "I think I'll write on the typewriter a little while. I think I'll write to Virginia and Robert." And then he runs, not walks, to the typewriter and bangs away. Harry has the worst case of stream of consciousness I have ever ran into, the roommates avow solemnly, but his eyes are bright with teasing. Harry guffaws loudly, and the other members of the delegation chuckle in sympathy. It is a warmly knit group, I feel, more like a family than a government-appointed committee. We go to the Olympus, one of the two Salonika restaurants recommended to the commission by the Greek government. Evidently, the government has supplied these two with extra food to satisfy the appetites of the visitors. I order the lamb dish, which the waiter assures me is the most Greek, and shortly a half head of lamb cut cleanly down the middle of his forehead, eyes, nose, mouth, is set before me. My insides quiver, but since I ordered it, I sit there and pick the brains. For one thing, I'm grateful the eye does not stare up at me. It is open against the plate. Salonika, I discover next morning, is packed with people. It looks as if twice its regular population must be crowded there, but the roommate says I exaggerate as usual. To be exact, 80,000 refugees, mostly from the burned villages of Macedonia, have lately been added to its former population of approximately 270,000. The roommate and I meet all of the refugees, I'm sure, and most of the regular inhabitants as we walk on the wide paved quay that extends for more than a mile along the bay to the White Tower. That is, we meet the males. The women, as usual in Greek crowds, are very scarce. The roommate worries considerably over the taboo against young men and women going out together unless they are engaged. He doesn't see how they can fall in love and get engaged unless they are allowed to be alone together. Though it is Sunday, there are large caiques unloading fruit and vegetables from either Crete or the Peloponnesus. One boat is loaded to the rim with loose lemons that shine with unusual brightness against the blue-green sea. Men are scrambling over them like monkeys, tossing them into deep baskets. Another boat is filled with oranges and dark green broad beans. Beyond the caiques, out in the bay, are many little boats, gay with Sunday excursionists. And beyond all the ships is the empty carpet of the wide blue sea. And on the other side of the sea, the white-robed queen, Mount Olympus, shrouded by her court of kneeling peaks. The bay here at Salonika is 65 miles wide, but in the clear, lucid light of the mountain shore looks only a few thousand yards or so away. Along the wharf are peddlers' wagons, divided into many squares and heaped with peanuts and almonds and pistachio nuts and pale green currants. Business, though, is slow. The Greek promenaders have no money to spend on toothsome tidbits. There are also men with wire boxes resembling bird cages piled with rolls over their shoulders. Like shrimp vendors in Savannah, they chant their wares in musical cadences, but the busiest people are shoeshine boys and photographers. They jockey for positions along the curb and in the parks. The promenaders of the morning, though, are few compared with those of the late afternoon. By 6 o'clock, the quay is solidly black with parading humanity. The street is closed to all vehicles. Only people on foot can move down the wide road and broad sidewalks. Walking and talking, they sound like the roar of a pounding surf. I stand with some friends on the third floor of the American consulate, which faces on the quay, and listen to them with awe and fascination. Slowly and unceasingly, they tramp down the long wharf and back again, down and back, and as they tramp, 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 they talk. There is no break, no let-up. It is a continuous, thundering, rumbling roll of noise. We move inside, tightly close the door to the balcony, and go into the kitchen in the rear of the apartment to help Mrs. Raleigh Gibson, the wife of the United States consul in Salonika, makes sandwiches. Still, the storm of shuffling feet and ceaseless words beats against us. We try not to listen. We determinedly begin to chatter. The prospect of the trip to Bulgaria excites us. The question of money comes up. Is there a black market in Bulgaria? Someone says the government is extremely harsh with people caught dealing in the black market. It sometimes gives them death sentences. Above the roar, Robert Conway, reporter of the New York Daily News, solemnly announces, "When I get there, I'm going to go strictly legal as far as money is concerned." "You'd better be careful, Conway," retorts Bob Vermilion of the United Press, "or you'll have a split personality." On and on we chat, eat, drink, but always we are conscious of that drilling hum of tongue and feet in the street. Now and then we stop to gauge it better. Is it dying down a little? Yes, it grows less and less and less, and by 10 there is none at all. The quay is deserted and the night is still. Like black clouds, the people have vanished. But where? The houses are too few and too small to absorb them. Nonetheless, they are gone. And they will not gather again until the coming Sunday, when they will start once more walking and talking, talking and walking and talking. To me, it is symbolic of the restlessness that is Greece. End of chapter 20.